welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record, brought to you by National Review. I am your host, David Bonson, and we are back on our normal Thursday routine this week. Last week was the first time ever the Capitol Record did not come out on a Thursday. We released on Tuesday, November 1st, because our very special guest, Nick Timiraos from the Wall Street Journal, and I had a lengthy discussion about the Fed, and we didn't think it made sense to publish it after the Fed's big meeting on November the 2nd. And so we got it out beforehand, and I hope you listened to that episode. I'll ask our next guest here in a second if he's had a chance yet to listen to it. But either way, the issue with the Fed that we talked about last week has been one big story in financial markets. And another big story has been the resignation of Prime Minister Liz Truss in the UK, who I now refer to as the Anthony Scaramucci of British politics, although she lasted a few weeks more than our friend Anthony did. But it is a rather intensely important economic story for reasons our next guest is about to talk to us about. Our next guest is now the first time, three-time guest on Capitol Record. We've had a handful that have been on twice now. We're coming up on 2 years, by the way, of Capitol Record, and it's amazing that we are mostly going without repeat guests. We continue to have really wonderful people. I've especially enjoyed this last month or so. I thought Larry Kudlow and Phil Graham and Vivek is obviously just always phenomenal. But so is our first three-time guest, my good friend Andrew Stutterford, who is the editor and head at National Review's Capital Matters. He joined me in what I believe was the second episode ever, it may have been the third, when the meme stock GameStop issues were going on. That feels like many moons ago. And then he joined us about a year ago now to kind of look at the state of the economy as we're coming into the year that has been 2022. But Andrew wrote a piece at Capital Matters that was, in my mind, absolutely perfect encapsulation of everything that needed to be said. And I want to unpack it further with him. So please welcome back to Capitol Record, Andrew Stutterford.
It's good to be here, David.
So, Andrew, I will just kind of dig in with a simple comment. That your article was phenomenal. I think one of the things that seems to me that has to be done before we talk about what did happen and what the problems were and what the problems weren't with what Liz Truss and her economic team attempted to do and with the overall economic landscape in UK, I think it would be helpful to kind of unpack what did not happen. And that's where your article was nuanced, in that you're offering a criticism of the way Truss and her team handled things. You're just not offering the criticism that the media wants you to offer.
No, I think that's right. I mean, what you could see, and you and I both understand the use, if you like, of narratives as propaganda, and basically Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, who was her Chancellor of the Exchequer, another rather short-lived term in office, they basically allowed the opposition to create a narrative, and which we will now live with for, I suspect, quite a few years. And the narrative is that they proposed a tax cutting scheme, a wild tax cutting scheme, about £45 billion, which would call it $50-something billion. And I don't, by the way, believe when people talk about the cost of a tax cut, that's not something I'm ever very happy with conceptually, for reasons, David, that you will understand. And
why don't we explain that? Because I think most listeners agree, but it's worth a little refreshing just for those who, whether it's economics or math, maybe you should unpack that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, and the first thing to remember about a tax cut is what a tax cut, and that's why I dislike the phrase tax break, actually, for the same reason. It's your money. And if the government, the logic by talking about a cost of a tax cut, and I do understand, of course, that it's a shorthand also, but its starting point is sort of the presumption that everything you earn belongs to the government, but then the government allows you to keep some of it. So if the government takes less from you, that is therefore a cost. Now, perhaps that's a simplistic way of looking at it, and it is in a way, but it's a framing. And the way that this debate is always framed is that there's a tax break. Oh, how kind of the tax man not to take your money if you do this, or it's going to cost X, it's going to cost Y if we cut taxes. Now,
I would argue, by the way, that you're there's three problems with that expression as a tax cut, as an expense, and you're highlighting the most important one. It's philosophical in the framing. It's a presupposition embedded in the vocabulary that what is ours belongs to government first, and then we're debating over what we get to keep versus vice versa. So you're exactly right. That's the most important. I think you can also make a supplementary argument that tax cuts have, in certain context, with the right planning and construction, been revenue enhancing. Yep. When they boost productivity by providing more incentive on the supply side. And we talk about this a lot, whether it's reductions in marginal rates on business income, corporate profits, investment income, or labor. In all three cases, over time, Kennedy, Clinton, Reagan, and Trump, and Bush Jr., we've seen enhancements of revenue. But I think the third thing is math. One man's input is another man's output.
Yeah.
So if we are talking about revenue to the government and we want to refer to a tax cut as a reduction of the revenue, that's fine. But then it's an increase in my income. And so for dual ledger accounting, let's get it right. And to your philosophical point, if we're going to pick one or the other, let's focus on the one that is the owner of the property.
Exactly. And let's just talk, go back to your second point for a moment. The first is that part of the tax cutting package was a reduction in the top rate of income tax from 45 to 40%. And that quotes cost $2 billion. Now, I don't know how they arrive at that number, to what extent they use dynamic scoring and so on. But the reality is not that much, but I'm totally guessing there. But the reality is that top rate tax cut isn't, you know, when they increase the rate, it didn't generate that much. And when they take it away, it's not going to generate that much. Equally, another aspect of the package is that the UK, which currently has a competitive advantage on corporation tax, corporate income tax, or corporate tax, as you call it in the US, is looking to increase it from, I think, 19% to 25%. Now, what the incoming Truss team said was that wasn't terribly sensible, particularly with tough economic times ahead, with companies being squeezed. And so we will cancel that planned increase. And now that, of course, has been reversed. And it was interesting to see people like Goldman Sachs, for example, saying that this is not going to help the economy, that this is going to, if the UK does go into recession, which I think it probably will, that this is going to make things worse. And that, of course, hits tax revenues in a recession. So the whole math is from start to finish was nonsense. However, they fell into the trap. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. So it would seem to me that going into a new administration in a time of economic vulnerability, in a time of the Bank of England, which we should probably reiterate, I'd love to hear your take on it. My summary has been that their central bank works much like the Fed does in relationship to our own Congress, which is different than the BOJ, where they have less interest in pretending there are lines of demarcation between their central bank and their political class. Where in the US and England, they do a fair job at presenting a posture of independence and a reasonable reality of independence as much as can be in the existence of a central bank. So yeah, our Congress has to approve, the president appoints, there is appearances before Congress. When push comes to shove, our Treasury Department and our central bank are clearly working in accord to administer certain elements of policy. So by most people's vocabulary, it's not exactly independence in a way many people would think of, the separation of church and state type of thing. Yet structurally, the administration and decision making of policy are separate. And I think England works the same way. Is that a fair summary, Andrew?
Yes, that's a very fair summary. The Bank of England is formally independent. It is, which was not the historical case. As a practical matter, it was independent for many, many years because it had enormous institutional clout. You didn't push around the Bank of England. If you were a government, you had to be careful about doing that. And a lot of, if you look at the UK's historical regulatory system, which the Bank of England, of course, kept a close eye on financial markets, the power of the Bank of England was such that it was always said that, well, you don't really, that I think the phrase was, a raised eyebrow was enough to bring a bank into line that was doing the wrong thing. And it was able to apply an enormous amount of pressure. Nevertheless, I can't remember the exact date, but when the Labour Party won election in 1997, they wanted to establish their financial credibility because we'd had a long period of conservative rule. And there was a lot of question marks. Could Labour be trusted to run the economy? And one of the things that they did was to make the Bank of England formally independent, and which I think was a good thing. The only thing one has to remember about it is that, and they are very capable people. I don't always agree with what they say, and nor would you expect to. You have to remember that any institution has an institutional bias, and any institution has its conventional wisdom. And it has to be said that their conventional wisdom, shall we say, was not the same as the, was not never likely to be that sympathetic to the Truss Kwarteng line. And it has now emerged that they failed, Truss and Kwarteng failed. I don't think can't remember whether this has been revealed by the time of my article. It might have been, but it wasn't public initially. That they normally, if you were going to do something drastic, you know, potentially drastic, you would have a word with the Bank of England, which of course follows the markets very, very carefully, particularly the markets in UK treasuries, which are called gilts, and said, how do you think this is going to fly? And it appears that, if the stories are true, that they did not have that consultation, and that was a mistake.
So it would be a mistake in any period, right? It would be a mistake in any new administration, in any time period that significant policy is going to be administered. But it seems that you argued an article, and I am in complete agreement with you, that it's almost unforgivably stupid in this situation, when it is at a period of the BOE itself taking unprecedented monetary action around tightening, around the removal of various accommodations that they have put into the economy via monetary policy, both just as the case with us with QE and a zero interest rate policy, they are in the midst of hiking rates. They are in the midst of tightening from their balance sheet, and to not have had that conversation strikes me as odd always and doubly odd now.
Yes, and I think that there are a couple of things one needs to add to the oddness of it. The first is the tax cuts or cancellation of proposed tax increases are only half the story. And it will take their math of the 45 billion. But there had been a few days before, it seems like a million years ago now, the government had already announced a massive support scheme because of the energy crunch in Europe, and that they were going to support consumers for 2 years. And the way that that worked was potentially an open-ended commitment, but it was at least probably going to be a three-figure £1 billion commitment, and then a 6-month commitment to support industry. Now, I understand the political rationale for it, and I think, by the way, that the fact that they did this shows that, contrary to the narrative that is now being spun, that these were not free market fundamentalists. They were well aware of political realities. And sooner or later, the Germans are doing something similar. A lot of European countries are going to go down this route. But if you add to the debt and the amount of debt, you can look at, there's a lot of different figures floating around. But UK debt to GDP is, depending on who you ask, really, was in about the 90%. And there are figures a little lower, some a little higher. You know, that's another reason just to be a little bit careful in an interest rate climate where the interest rates are rising, bond vigilantes are back. You want to make sure that the markets are not going to be panicked. And two things happened, failed to happen. We've talked about the Bank of England, but then they also did not consult something called the OBR, which is a sort of scorekeeper. It says if you increase spending by this, this will be the economic impact and so on.
And I read that in your piece, Andrew, and I wanted to ask you this. Is it equivalent to CBO?
Sort of. It was introduced, ironically, by the Conservatives in opposition as a sort of phantom thing.
To be a governor on spending?
Yeah, and it was just basically they did it just to score what was going on with the Labour Party. I think they introduced it in 2009, but then when they came into office in 2010, it then was incorporated into the civil service. And again, it has its institutional biases, but they were, it is well respected. And unlike the Bank of England thing, which no one knew, everyone knew that the OBR had not looked at this plan. So that doesn't inspire confidence. The second thing that happened, so you had the Bank of England, and then I said there were two others. And the second thing that happened was Kwarteng, the finance minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, fired the permanent secretary, which is the top guy in the UK Treasury Department. And no one really knows why. And obviously the rumor is that he didn't like what he saw was being planned. And so you'd set, firstly, you hadn't done your homework, and secondly, you had given the market reason to be suspicious of what was going to get, of what all this could mean. Had we got irresponsible people at the helm, basically?
So I started off by saying I wanted to dive into what didn't happen. And it strikes me that everything you're saying so far is that there was not coordination that as there should have been with the central bank. There was not process as there should have been with OBR. There was not a thoughtfulness into the way they went about doing it. And I am pointing out that this is happening in concert with unprecedented levels of monetary tightening. With all of that said, if the right process had been followed, if the right communication existed, discussion of how to go about executing and palatability in the market and some of these other elements were properly attentioned, do you believe the media narrative that the reduction of marginal rates caused the bond market to go into disarray, and that the over-levered pension funds were in pandemonium because of Thatcher Reagan-like philosophy.
No, and you've just touched in one line the over-levered pension funds.
And so we'll come back to that. I want you to know it pained me to even use the words to ask that question.
What happened? You, and this is a conversation I'm sure you don't mind me sharing with our listeners here, that you have signaled to me that we need to be looking at stresses emerging around about the place. If you read Capital Matters, which you should. You will see occasionally pieces which are headlined with have somewhere in the headline tremors. And that comes from my conversations with David Barnson, a sort of follow-up from that in my thinking. I look for things that are showing signs of stress because we are in a new world. And that new world is that of rising interest rates. I don't know how long it's going to continue, but I do know with a fairly high degree of confidence that we're not going to go back to the, and I think it's good that we're not going back to the basically near zero rates that we saw in the previous decade. I think that there's another whole, we could do another whole show where why I think that's unhealthy. And I think, I know, David, you agree. And the question is, if you like, the markets have had a holiday from reality for 10 years. And when that starts to unravel, it starts to unravel and things start to go wrong. Thus, the tremors, you know. In the case of the pension funds, what happened was, and this explains how the narrative was then able to be framed, because in reality, what they were proposing, stupidly handled, although it was, and then we can get back to what they should have done a bit later, if, David, you want, didn't merit the sort of panic that we did actually see, even if you allow for the fact that it was whipped up somewhat, I think, in the financial press, which is much, unlike Capital Matters, is much more to the left than it was. They were horrified by the cut on the top rate of tax. But something else was going on. And what was going on is in the era of, in the UK, as the backstory, you have far more fixed benefit pension plans than you do in the US. Some historic, some current, but you've got them. If you are a responsible pension fund manager, where do you put the money? You put it in gilts, UK treasuries. Nothing wrong with that at all. However, if interest rates on gilts are 0.5%, how on earth are you going to meet your liabilities? And so what they bought to your pension, to your pensioners, actual or prospective. So what they did is they bought was it liability derived investment or something like that, LDIs, I think. And they what they really were, there was a lot of fancy talk about hedging, nonsense. What this was designed to do was to soup up returns by playing around with our old friends' derivatives. And the Bank of
England. I think your point's an important one. If one was buying a derivative in a pension to hedge a risk, yeah, to hedge volatility, to hedge interest rates, there's various reasons that derivatives, to me, are very legitimate instrumentation in finance.
Totally.
But all we're talking about when we talk about our old friends' derivatives, it's not a sort of Warren Buffett, let's cloud the waters by acting as if we think swaps are intrinsically evil. By the way, very few people own more swaps than Warren Buffett. But regardless, the use of LDIs was explicitly to leverage higher the yield. It was a yield enhancement derivative that required a little bit of money to get a lot of upside exposure to yield. And of course, a cost means if the value of your bonds comes against you, then you face margin calls because you're levered. You've borrowed from the house to put the position on. So I just want to, because of our focus on defending capital markets, when you and I have to talk negatively about the way one used a derivative, I don't want anyone to assume we're talking about the evil of the existence of derivatives. We're dealing with the very simple reality here of what LDIs, particularly on British gilts, represented inside these pension funds.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong with hedging a portfolio. Derivatives have been around, well, in one form or another, actually, for centuries. Yeah. And it's when they are used speculatively that we move into different territory, and then one has to be more, should we say, more careful. But let's look at that word careful. The Bank of England, and here we go back to how these very low interest rates distorted everything. The Bank of England actually did look at LDIs a year or so ago, and they basically concluded that there was no risk. And how did they come to that conclusion? Because they thought that it was inconceivable that interest rates could move by more than 1% in a week. And in the climate of the old ultra low interest rate climate, perhaps that was credible. Actually, in my own financial career, we generally always operated on an agency basis, but there was one product which was where we did have to take principal risk, albeit for only typically 20 minutes or half an hour. But as David knows, 20 minutes and half an hour can turn into an eternity if things go wrong. And I hired this risk officer, a nice guy, and it was at a time after the 08, 09 and all that. And all these people saying, well, under my watch, I only lost $100 million. And I think, good Lord, that really would be a bit rough for us. And I found a tough Texan in the end, and he sorted things out. But when we were modeling, I said, just give me one line on, and I call it the Armageddon line. If every correlation breaks down, how much could we actually lose? Because that's what I always want to think about. And so the Bank of England, I don't think, had an Armageddon line, or they defined Armageddon as 1%. And of course, what we had is we had volatility in one day of more than that. And that sent everything into a spiral. As you said, the collateral margin calls were made. You got into a doom loop, and the Treasury market went crazy. The pound collapsed, and the Bank of England then stepped in. So at the same time as it was doing a policy of, you know, wanting to tighten, it was also buying bonds. And the whole
thing. So let's bring in Liz Truss and tax decreases here. Did the margin calls on pension funds, LDIs, happen because someone started talking about tax cuts?
What happened was, yes, and yes and no. I mean, yes, more than no. Basically, what happened was when the scheme was announced, scheme sounds as a bad word, but when the mini budget was announced, that sent gilts, government bonds, they sent yields rising. There's no doubt there's a direct correlation, whether it was right or wrong, it did. And I think it needn't necessarily have done if they'd done their homework, but they hadn't. However, were they responsible for the fact that a bad day in the gilts market then became an absolute nightmare? The answer is no. That was the fault of the LDIs. That was the fault of the bank, and they should have known that this minefield was there? And the answer was, I don't think they should. If they had asked the Bank of England, the Bank of England would have said, you've got no need to worry.
The tricky part about the use of leverage finance in dealing with causation and correlation is, in a lot of ways, I'm asking you a really unfair question. And I, working in finance, am asked all the time, why did the market drop today? Why did it go up today? What these various things? And we're all allowed to posit a theory, and we have a great advantage in that they're always non-falsifiable. There's nobody that can ever prove we're wrong. and yet we can never really prove we're right either. But you know, the 30-year in the United States went up about 60 basis points in a month. and we didn't raise taxes or cut taxes or talk about cutting taxes. Theirs did go up more, but the point you make is the important one. It was the chain reaction. If one wants to claim that there was a disruption in the bond market at the mention of tax cuts, I'll take it. I am not willing to conclude that I know with certitude that there would not have been the same thing had there not been, but there's no question as a matter of correlation that, you know, it did rain before the sidewalk was wet, and I'm perfectly willing to say the sidewalk was wet from the rain, but I'm not willing to say that there couldn't have been another spill or another puddle or another incident that would have also wet the sidewalk. It's immaterial to the point you're making that what went from a bad day in the bond market to a month that created the resignation of Liz Truss was much more than just the policy discussion of tax cuts.
Oh yes. I think that's definitely the case. And you and I have seen enough of these over the years. There was sheer hysteria. Also, hysteria took over. The press coverage was insane. You had a few wise voices saying, "Look, this is absolute madness." The market reaction. The UK is not about to go bust. I read somewhere that the UK actually has never defaulted. It came pretty close. Thank you, Uncle Sam, in 1945, to defaults. And it has the fortune. It does not have in any real sense a reserve currency, unlike the US. But the fact is the UK. You might have to pay a higher yield, but the UK can print its own. It uses debt primarily in pounds. It wasn't going to go bust, so this was overdone. But I think that the way that this was received was that this switch to a, and I use the word somewhat loosely, a more supply-side approach to the economy, a tax-cutting approach to the economy, an approach to the economy where progressive taxation was not of itself seen as, you know, this is the greatest thing since sliced. It's a moral crime to cut the top rate of tax, incidentally, to the level at which it had stood for throughout most of the years of the Labour government, or maybe even all of the years of the Labour government under Blair and Brown. And there were a lot of people willing, I think, Truss and Kwarteng to fail. And that helps explain a lot of the response that we saw.
And so the takeaways I get on the positive side, like Andrew Stutterford saying, here's what positively needs to be done better in the future, is coordination with others, a far better attempt at communicating policy, the sort of general related ideas around technique. What I don't hear is that philosophically, the reduction of tax rates has now become something that is unsafe for the sovereign debt of the world, whether it's UK or US or whatnot. And so I would love to see the Prime Minister of UK, the President of the United States, very few countries, developed nations on earth that I believe are undertaxed. And so I would love to see removal of impediments to productivity, both as a significant decrease of inflationary pressures, because I'm on the side that most of the inflation is supply related, but also as a means of producing economic growth and prosperity. And yet, I don't want disarray in the bond market, a prime minister only serving a Scaramucci-length term. We all want technique. What would you do to harmonize these interests if you were Liz Truss for a day or 41 days?
41 days. What I would do is maybe a little bit more of what, because we can't, unfortunately, we can't roll the clock back. But let's say I'm Liz Truss for a day. And remember, another thing that I'm coping with, if I am, is she was not a known figure, particularly in the markets. She was inexperienced. She was not considered, I think very unfairly, not considered one of the brightest bulbs that there was. I think that's absolute nonsense. And I'm old enough to remember the condescension that greeted Mrs. Thatcher when she became leader of the Conservative Party. And some of the ways in which Liz Truss was spoken about reflected that, which is not to say she was Mrs. Thatcher, although she certainly wanted to be, and a praiseworthy ambition. So she also needed to remember she herself was a bit of an unknown quantity to the markets and was being mocked. So that didn't help either. But what would I do? And I have some hope that her successor, Rishi Sunak, in time is going to get there, because he is more technocratic. He sometimes describes as Davos man. He's not that. His instincts are okay. But what I would do is actually what Mrs. Thatcher did is say, look, the direction that we are going to head in this country is towards deregulation. And she did a lot of things straight away, which were deregulatory, most notably, actually, the ending of exchange controls, capital controls on currency. But we've got to keep an eye on the budget as well. And Mrs. Thatcher was the grocer's daughter, and she was very keen on keeping it up, making sure that the she didn't like debt very much. And so what I would do is I'd set out a roadmap, and I would put a few candies at the beginning of the roadmap, if you like, to say, we are going to cut this tax. We are cutting this tax. We are reducing one of the things they did do, they reduced the equivalent of Social Security payments, and that so far has endured. And we will not penalize companies by increasing taxes as we're maybe about to approach a recession. However, be under no doubt, what I want to see is a reduction in income taxes. And I see no particular merit in higher rate income taxes just for the sake of them. And when the books make it possible, that's where we're going, and have no doubt. And if you look at how Mrs. T did, which is not an alternative so much in the US, is there was a very, because I said she really did watch the fiscal situation very carefully. And so there, the grand deal, if you like, was that she cut direct taxes fairly dramatically in a couple of stages, and note that couple of stages, people forget that she was an incrementalist, but she increased indirect taxes. And I myself have always got a bias towards taxing consumption rather than income. And that deal has been done. You know, the indirect taxes are now very high in the UK, consumption taxes are very high in the UK. But so what I would do is I would just say, we're going back to the supply side, we're doing deregulation. The big problem, and Rishi Sunak has unfortunately today caved on it, is the biggest problem, I think, on the supply side in the UK to encouraging growth and development, other than the tax and overregulation, is that the UK has signed up for net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Now, if you want, there's a lot of talk about uncosted tax cuts. Well, I'm sorry, I'm ranting here, but the uncosted tax cuts, you know, we've had that discussion just now. Well, when net zero was passed, which was a much, much, much bigger deal, that was uncosted. That was uncosted for two, and that was passed by acclamation in the House of Commons, essentially. And it was uncosted for. It's now been costed, but the numbers are meaningless. No one knows what's going to happen, and no one knows really how it's going to work. And Sunak has got to get to grips with the net zero problem, because net zero is politically possible, politically popular at the moment. but is economically, as currently arranged, is economically disastrous. And he somehow has to square that circle. And because when it becomes, it's ultimately going to become unbelievably unpopular. And whoever's in charge at the time will have hell to pay. But in the meantime, he's got to start reconnecting the net zero ambitions with some sort of reality. So I'd also be saying that.
Well, and I think it's a great place for us to close, because I think supply siders and those who hold to a more limited view of government, and those like you and I have talked about today in our criticism of the way Liz Truss handled this, who do value process and technique and want to be, as Thatcher was, as Reagan was, productive. I've reminded people several times over the last few weeks, the way in which the Kemp tax cuts and then the really gigantic 82 tax cut was passed were years in the making. I think Jude Winiski and Bob Bartley at the Wall Street Journal wrote something like 700 op-eds, even talking about the different things that Art Laffer and Bob Mundell and others. A lot of this has been very well documented in Brian Dmitrovich's book, Econoclasts, that the supply side movement was sold to the American people. It was debated in the academy. It was put forward in media. It was ultimately an item of persuasion in the Congress. And it was in the soft and indirect sense you're talking about, in accord with Volcker's Fed. There was a juxtaposition of this sort of economic handling. So I am critical on the way in which she handled it. But I would point out to your point around net zero carbon and my unfair question of what would Andrew Studdiford do if prime minister for 41 days, we are not being asked to say what we would do about spending. We're not given that lever. And so when the supply siders say, look, I can get tax cuts done, we want to do it. But then when guys like Stockman or Bruce Bartlett or others who become critical of it say, oh, but you people have spent us into oblivion, a big part of me is in agreement with them. I would like you to make me king for a day where I get to lower tax rates and lower the size of government, but I can't lower the size of government in one day. I can't do a depression-inducing austerity in one day. And now Liz Truss has set back the cause to some degree because people want to say, tax cuts, look at that, they're even bad for the bond market, at a time in which these statists and Keynesians have created more vulnerability in financial system bond markets than ever any time in history. So I think we have our work cut out for us, but ultimately we want to have this policy discussion and give answers around those kinds of questions that are somewhat fictitious. What would you do in 40 days, Andrew? The fact of the matter is, Andrew's laid out for you guys today a really important point. Net zero is the problem. Okay, you have the developed world going towards an environmental policy that is untenable. It is not particularly environmental. It is economically fatal. And yet everyone is being asked to conduct fiscal and monetary policy as if this environmental atrocity is really going to happen. And it is complicating things. It is skewing, distorting, as we like to say, economic decision-making and calculus. So please read Andrew's link. I'm going to post it in the show notes. Fantastic article at Capital Matters. Andrew, maybe give us one closing thought and we'll wrap it up here.
I think one closing thought is when you read about Liz Truss's mania, and you've got to remember, in the end, we should be about what are free markets for? They are for growth, for human flourishing. The reality is that the UK's growth, and it's not only the UK, has been lamentable for 20 years, and the productivity growth has slowed. And again, the UK is not alone in this. And we can't go on like this. You cannot have a stagnant economy. And what she was trying to do is a UK phrase, and it has a very unhappy history. So I use it cautiously, called a dash for growth. But what she was trying to do, and those aren't always, most of those have been unsuccessful. But what she was trying to do is saying, look, for our economy to work and our society to work, we have to get growth. And growth is elusive. So the one way we can get growth, I think, said Liz Truss, is to give it back to the agents of entrepreneurialism and to the people. And that's the best way forward. And that, the principle, to me, has been right ever since I've been following the news. And that principle remains unchanged. And the tragedy of Liz Truss is if the failure of execution and clumsy mistakes are allowed to cloud the reality, is that the only way forward is growth. And the only way for growth is for proper growth is for free markets to be allowed to do their thing.
Amen, my friend. Could not agree more. What a great discussion, Andrew. Thank you so much. Third time's a charm. The other two were great as well. Kudos on your tremendous accomplishment of being the first three-time guest on Capitol Record.
Great honor.
And for all of you listening, please do subscribe, rate us 5 stars, help us boost our visibility in your players and worldwide access. And most importantly, thank you for joining us in the cause of a free and virtuous society. Andrew's closing comments are exactly at the heart of what we do. We do believe that growth is the great economic need of the day, and that the moral charge in human flourishing is embedded in us promoting the cause of prosperity comes from free enterprise. That's what Capitol Record is about. It's what National Review's Capitol Matters is about. And we look forward to coming to you again next week with a very special guest, Dr. Samuel Gregg, who we will be discussing his brand new book on American economics, the American prosperity, and it's going to be a fun one. So look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks for listening to The Capitol Record.